Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I am Harry Brady and this is podcast number 233.
Sure it's a grand old team to play for. Sure it's a grand old team.
This week, a blast in the past returns as we are joined by Hull Boy to discuss his impressions of the Diala Celtic performances so far and the forthcoming League Cup semi-final Glasgow Derby. Banned from Kerrydale Street for I've no idea what, regular on the Huddle Board and Twitter, I'm sure Hull Boy will have something very interesting to say. So enough from me, this is me, Harry Brady, with him, Hull Boy. So, Hull Boy, I don't think we've had a conversation since Ronnie Dial has got into full flow. So, before we talk about the big game at the weekend, League Cup semi-final, first of all, Ronnie Dial, give me your thoughts.
Well, it's been a while, Harry, so welcome to Celtic, Ronnie Dial. So I think the media will give him an easy ride, actually.
Yeah. Everything's been hunky-dory. The media love him.
Absolutely.
And move on.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, no, not tried to trip him up at all. Not put him on the spot in press conferences. Never really put him under any pressure. And let's fast forward now to today.
Right, first of all, burning hot topic, two up front or one up front? What's your thoughts? What's your take on the formation?
I'm going to give the politician's answer and say, well, let's just unpack the Ronnie Dial thing, because I think, not with hindsight, but just the reality of this season, I think Ronnie Dial had to change the team. He had to change the style of the team. He had to change the way in which the squad played together. It's clear that there are certain things that he wants from a Celtic team, from any team that he manages. And when he inherited the current squad, some of those things were evident. And I think if you listen to what he's been saying during the season, he's been working towards achieving some of those things. Having said that, I can see that he was changing things from the early games, really. I think he got caught out with the European stuff. He maybe didn't bring in as many players as he would have liked in an ideal world. I'm not actually sure that was anything to do with Peter Lowell. I think it was probably more about Ron Dial thinking, I need some time with these players to see if any of them can make it. And you have to remember that he's also quite a few injuries to contend with during the season. So I actually think he's doing a good job. I can see things. I can see things in the way, in the style of the team that we just didn't see in previous seasons. And I know from comments that have been made that he's got a philosophy that is slightly different. You know that if Celtic are playing well and the game's won, he still wants them to go forward. He doesn't want them to take the foot off the gas. If you look at how high the fullbacks are playing compared with previous seasons, I know they've always been attacking fullbacks, but they're playing even higher up the park to create more problems for the opposition. So the actual, we know where it comes from. People have been debating. Lots of people are saying, "Oh, Celtic have traditionally always played with two strikers. Therefore, they should always play with two strikers." I just don't see that. I see far more movement and interaction with the current style of play and the current formation than we had when we were watching 4-4-2 in previous seasons.
I mean, you make a point which is always my bugbear about people talking about whether one up front is negative and two up front is attacking. And I've also seen people refer to him playing two defensive midfield players. But as you've just said, in effect, for most of our domestic games, we play two up front, two at the back, two centre-halves.
At times, we are playing if you want to go in terms of where people are positioned on the park, we're playing five up front. We're playing a left-back and a right-back so far up the park, along with an interchanging three interchangeable attackers. So you've got five players there, and I just don't see this kind of clamour for saying we must play a traditional 4-4-2 with two strikers. It wouldn't achieve anything particularly.
It's also like one of these things when people refer back to wanting a halcyon time of the way it used to be.
Yeah.
When they're not really wanting the way it used to be, they're wanting the way it was for a 20-year, 25-year window.
Yeah.
Because if you spoke to someone who was our age in the 1950s and talked about only playing two up front,
yeah,
they would be criticising you for being playing negative football with only two up front.
Exactly, because they would have been used to, the W formation or the M formation or whatever, you know. And they would be thinking along the lines of, yeah, well, the game's played as a 2-3-5.
And that's
what we're used to, you know, with two really wide wingers. Well, the fullbacks are the modern day wingers.
Yep. So there was a lot of talk. I certainly remember having heated debates with people on Twitter, particularly around about October, November time, when people were saying it was just a shambles, and I was saying I could see signs of progress and change. I remember people would then say, tell me what the change is, because I can't see it. It just looks a mess to me. Do you think there's anything he could have done different at the beginning to win some of the doubters over? Or do you think it was just circumstances of everything about things?
I think it was circumstances, and I think if things weren't quite set up the way that they were, I think there may well have been a bit more pressure on him when results didn't go our way. But there were some games, funnily enough, there were some games that we didn't win and our performance was pretty good. And it was unfortunate that we didn't win. And you know, people don't look at performances when we have won by the odd goal, they may do occasionally, and think, well, actually, our performance wasn't very good. I mean, actually, the Ross County game was possibly a case in point. But I think that was down to conditions as well. So, you know, I mean,
I think the
people are always going to put Celtic under more scrutiny if they don't win a game. It just goes with the territory. We know that we're gonna discuss, you know, what went wrong type of thing. But I think probably with, you know, I'm going to sound like Hugh Keaton's here, with social media, the internet, everything, people have got more time and more capacity and more space to actually analyse the game and possibly overanalyse it, and tend to look for the negatives of what went wrong rather than, you know, the more medium-term, long-term things that the manager's trying to achieve. You know, it was evident to me from the first few games that he was trying to get his team to play a more pressing game when the opposition had the ball, and to do that pressing higher up the park. Well, if you see other teams doing that in Europe, you know, you see the same supporters saying, wow, that's really good. That's exactly what we would want from from a team. That's good football. But they are, you know, they almost got a blind spot to the fact that Celtic were doing it.
I think one of the funniest examples of that was at the time when there was the conversation about Ronnie Dyla wanting the team to be fitter and eat healthier.
Yeah.
And then, I can't remember, we played somebody, one of the teams in Europe, and I remember pundits saying things like, it was one of the games we won at home, maybe Dynamo Zagreb at home, I think it was.
Yeah. The media was shocking over the diet thing.
And the funny thing was, the media was saying, Ronnie Dyla should ignore all this chat about diet and fitness and focus on the fact that Celtic were run off the park by Dynamo Zagreb.
Mm.
I mean, if they run off the park, then he should be focusing on the fitness.
Absolutely. But the thing is, and it's not always straight away, and to a certain extent, the media control what information comes out. But it's quite clear that a lot of the players themselves have said, yeah, we've had a chat with the manager, we know what he's trying to achieve, we know that we had to get our fitness levels up, we know that we had to play a more pressing game, we know that we had to do more passing, we know that we had to, you know, interchange more. You know, so it's just a more dynamic type of football. And sometimes what we get caught up in supporters is we just look at it because it's our team. And so it makes it more difficult for us to actually stand back and actually realise, look, you've got a guy here who's new. Yes, he's a football manager, but at the end of the day, he's a manager of a profession, and he's got people who are professionals, and he wants them to do their job in a certain way. And he looks at it in that way. And it's like you or I, if we're in a working situation and we've got a boss who comes along and says, I want you to do your job, but I want you to do it in this way, then you kind of think, okay, that's new for me. I'm going to have to do things a bit differently. I might have to learn a few things. I might have to have a different outlook about how I do that. But we kind of almost ignore that, paradigm, if you like, with regards to football.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of, I remember I've also read people at the beginning of it, and you touched on it there, with people coming out and reports in the press of the players being very negative, and people say, see, the players don't like it. Well, your example there, where a new boss comes along, says he wants things done differently.
Yeah.
You can imagine you going out on a Saturday night with your mates. You were saying you get a new boss, he's an arse, he wants us to do this. Yeah. What does he know about it? I mean, he's never done it.
Yeah.
Then, after a while, actually, your job becomes a bit easier. You enjoy it a bit more. Mm. 3-6 months down the line, how's things with the new boss? Actually, do you know, he's not as bad as I first thought.
Yeah.
In fact, he's actually better than the last guy because we're getting paid more commission, or we get to finish earlier on a Friday, or, you know, there'll be things in that at first, because humans don't like change, everybody will whinge about it.
Yeah. Obviously, if you're not the boss, but, you know. no, seriously, that is it in a nutshell for me. And that's what I'm saying, you know, that they're professional footballers. We like watching football, you know, we like to play in football, but, you know, we were professional footballers. We didn't see it as our job. And I think there are definite signs, certainly with certain players, where they thought, yeah, do you know what? I'm going to give this a go. I want to be a different professional from the one that I was previously. I want to do more in the game. And, you know, I've seen Johansson getting criticism, but actually, you know, we all talk about Scott Brown being a mentor, and I think. All of the players will probably look up to Scott Brown for certain attributes and what he brings to the team. But I actually think Johansson is the player that is seen as a bit of an exemplar, you know. And I don't have a problem with Ronnie, you know, people saying, oh, it's his pet player. But he has the attributes that you would want from most of your players in the team. Is Aguirre's the same, but is he playing? He's playing wider, so you know he's still playing in an influential role, but you know it's not somebody who's kind of covering acres of ground in the middle of the park, trying to pull defenders and opposition midfielders all over the place, which Johansson does.
Now, in that regard, who do you think are the players that have changed most through the course of this season?
It's an interesting one, that. Well, funnily enough, I think Stokes has. I think his attitude is slightly different. I think if you take the fullbacks, I think the fact of the matter is they are just playing higher up the park. So I think they've got the same skill set. I think Izzy is having a marvellous season, by the way. I think he's doing really, really well. But he's playing five, on average, he's playing 10, 20 yards further forward for more of the game.
Yep.
Than he was under the previous management. So that changes the shape. Matthews is doing the same on the right. So to a certain extent, because of those tactical changes, it makes them look kind of either different or possibly better players. And I'm not sure that they are actually better players, but they're being played in better positions on the park. You know, in terms of the zones that they play in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we talk about zonal marking at set pieces, but, you know, modern football is about players, when they're moving on the park, about playing in certain zones as well. So, I think from that perspective, they've improved. I think Johansson, you know, I thought he was good under Neil Lennon, but he's obviously been asked to do a lot more under Ronnie Dyla, and I think for the most part, he's doing it, so he's improved. Beaton is getting a run of games, and I think he's a really, really good quality, solid player, and he's got some attributes of Ki Song Young about him, in that he's got the ability to retain possession, and I think that's key. We've then got players who obviously you can't judge whether they're better or not this season, because you know they've only come this season. People like Denaya, who I think is a smashing player. We're not going to be able to hold on to him, because I think he is a quality defender, even at his young age.
Yeah.
The two games that he's played since he came back, he's been exceptional, really. And he just got a really good fit with Van Dijk. So, yeah, it's difficult to say who else has kind of really improved, but I think it's more about the way in which the team is set out that brings the improvements.
And I suppose touching on your point about performance over results, you know, some of the games we played well, and for me, the two games that exemplify some supporters online seem to not understand the difference between performance and result is the criticism we got for the Hamilton game at home, where we lost, where we had something like 80% possession, and the praise we got away in the next game to Ross County because we scored five goals. But for me, we played better football against Hamilton than we did game against Ross County.
Yeah, and I think that's just the way it goes. I mean, at the end of the day, we've all got our own opinions, and people see the game differently. But there is something in that you know, you can have a decent performance, and people don't see that because of the result.
I suppose that the thing that people, critics of Ronnie Dyla and guys who really push for the concept of more than one up front, would then identify, okay, accepting your point that we are having 65, 70, 75% possession in every game, why are we not scoring 5-6 goals in every game?
Yeah.
And it would be the lack of penetration that would be the criticism people would have. How do you think he resolves that?
Yeah, I think there is some of that, and you know, maybe I am traditionally, in one sense, that I still think we need an out-and-out striker, and it actually would be interesting to see how Hooper would get on in the current setup. You know, because you know, I mean, nobody could dispute that he was a prolific goal scorer. But whether he could do it in that kind of interchanging way, I'm actually not. I know he's scoring for Norwich again now. I'm not actually sure how Norwich set up, whether they play, you know, kind of 4-2-3-1 formation. But maybe for a little while we thought Guidetti was going to be the answer, but and I still think he could be. I think he's a decent player. It's like all, you know, people say it's all strikers. You know, they need goals to keep up their confidence. So I think the resolution is really if we can find one of those forward players who can just start getting a few goals again, and you know, things will click in my view.
And of course, the other thing that has had a debate amongst supporters, which interestingly, the majority of supporters I know think one way, yet when the media are covering the story and they say what the Celtic supporters think, it is the complete opposite, and that's Chris Commons. Because majority of fans I know say, do you know what, if he doesn't fit into the Ronnie Dyla system, he doesn't fit into the system, never mind. Yet the media are saying Celtic fans are desperate for him to stay and play every week.
Well, again, I mean, online, I spoke about Commons, you know, in the kind of first few weeks of Ronnie Dyla being there. And I mean, okay, he's come back into the team recently, but I just think Commons' whole style, you can say which I do, you know, he doesn't suit the Ronnie Dyla style in some respects, work rate and certain other things, you know, which I'm not saying Commons is a greedy player. I think Commons likes the ball in a different way to the way in which some of the modern coaches want players to hold the ball. I think Commons is kind of old school in that respect, in that once he's got the ball, he likes a few touches on it. He obviously wants to try and do something with it. You know, he's not you know, just trying to play a keeper up here or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But I think he just wants to dwell on the ball too long. And most modern coaches do not want their team, they don't want the players in their teams to be holding onto the ball too long, particularly in the attacking areas. They want quick, one-touch football, make something happen. Because in the modern game, it's like everything else, everything gets more and more sophisticated and technical, and defences are pretty good these days.
Yep.
They're well drilled. They know what they're doing. They've got a job to do. So if you're a team that's spending 60% of your time on the attack, and you've got 60-70% of possession, you've still got to break down very well organised teams defensively. And if you've got a player like Commons who is taking a lot of time on the ball, that doesn't always suit the overall requirements of the team. So for me, I always thought it would be difficult for Commons to kind of fit into what Ronnie Dyla was trying to achieve. And, you know, he's been good for us. He's been good for Celtic. And it's been great seeing some of his goals. But I actually don't think that we would miss him that much.
So we've touched on the players and we've touched on him. He has played the last two or three games.
Yeah, he's done okay. You know, you get all the talk as to whether, oh, well, is this a bit of sentiment? Is he still going to be going by the end of the January window? And is he just being given these kind of like swan songs so that he can say goodbye to the sport? And I mean, it was pretty bizarre him throwing his boots into the crowd. And you have to wonder whether, because these things change on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to wonder whether, you know, at that point, you know, things were looking different and that there was something on somewhere else. And I found it very interesting in the last post-match interview, which you don't always hear players saying when they're talking about, you know, potential moves or signing a new contract, you know. And he said something about, he was almost saying as though it was his agent's decision, that it wasn't his decision.
And your point about things changing, I got a text in the middle of that game to say that Celtic had an offer that matched the evaluation, but that it wasn't from Bolton.
So Chris Commons got that text as well, did he?
Well, I do wonder whether Chris Commons knew that there was an offer in that matched his thing, and then so he chucks, you know, so he's thinking, brilliant. Chucks his boots into the crowd, comes off, his agent says, right, got more than that offer. It's from, I don't know, whoever. And he says,
we're not going.
I'm not going there.
but do you know what? I don't know how much say. Well, they all play games, footballers, over these things. And you never know who to believe. But he was really, really kind of strongly emphasising that, you know, this was all down to his agent, you know. So.
And again, as I often think with professional footballers, not obviously guys at Thistle and wherever on £1,000 a week or whatever they're on, but, you know, Celtic wage level players and upwards. Really, really, if I was 31, living in Glasgow and really liked it and settled in Glasgow, and my wife liked it in Glasgow, and my kids were at Chris Robbins' age.
He did talk about the schools and things like that.
I have to say, if I was a millionaire and I was offered to drop my salary from £1 million a week to £700,000 a week, I think I would stay. But obviously players think differently to me.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you're right there. It is down to kind of like personal circumstances based around family and you know, whether you like a particular place or whether you fancy another place that is on offer, you know. And, you know, I mean, Bolton's not the greatest of places, is it, if it's Bolton? But, you know, I mean, He's got all around the greater Manchester area where there are a lot of other professional footballers. But there are all kinds of things. I mean, obviously, his wife's got heavily involved in charitable work. We've already talked about, you know, his kids and schools. So, you know, I guess it's like any other family. Those things are all going to come into consideration, aren't they?
Not
just what you get paid.
So we've talked about the team and players and formation. So we have, and we're fortunate enough that the team have now had 6 months together. When we're getting into the deciding time for competitions like the league and cup games. So we have a cup game coming up at the weekend, a League Cup semi-final. How do you think we're going to perform in that? And what are the dangers against the team that we're playing against?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the thing is, you're just playing against a team that's, you know, in complete disarray, really. So it's, you know, all the kind of off-field shenanigans that are kind of getting all the headlines. At this moment in time, you look at what Celtic have been doing, you look at the way that they've been playing generally, even when the results haven't gone for them, and, you know, they've been generally, you know, far better than the opposition, even in games that they've lost. So playing against a team that doesn't appear to be doing anything of any note from a league that's lower, I can't see why, you know, Celtic shouldn't win the game comfortably, really.
How do you see this? How do you see the game going?
Well, funnily enough, I see the game go, from Celtic's perspective. Mm-hmm. I see the game going in the usual manner, really. That Celtic are going to take the game to the opposition. They're the ones that are going to be retaining possession, holding possession, playing the ball out from the back. You know, no long ball, hoofing style. It's going to be passing. We're obviously going to lose possession at points, which means that, you know, you will see the usual players pressing the opposition from really high up the park. And I can't emphasise that enough. That is something that we've seen this season that hasn't always been evident in Celtic teams since probably Martin O'Neill's era. Because I don't think Strachan's teams really pressed the opposition high up the pitch. You know, I think they knew when to close down the opposition, as did Neil Lennon's teams. But you know what Ronnie Dyer's got is he's got players and he's got an attitude that is trying to close the opposition down right from the back. And I think if you're playing a team from a lower division, who by definition won't be as technically competent, that's going to either make them panic, make them make errors, and just lose possession very quickly, which is exactly what that game plan is all about.
Now, the thing that I noticed, I've not watched much of our opponents in their 3 years, but I did see a bit of when they played Hearts at Tynecastle, and I actually was at my dad's, and I said to my dad, the League Cup semi-final is going to need a strong referee because they're just going round and kicking people.
Yeah.
And then straight after that was when they had a player sent off. And the other thing that I said was they're just hoofing the ball up the park to big men and then running after it.
Yeah. I think there was one game, yeah, it might have been that game. Yeah, was that the one where they had a man sent off and...
Should have had another two.
They should have had a couple more sent off.
Yeah.
And you know, I think to a certain extent, teams at that level, you know, if you got a team that's got, you know, journeymen and players who, you know, they're still going on, but, you know, they've seen better days. You know, maybe what happens is when they're in that position, their own frustration starts to kind of come out and they just resort to kind of physical things. So we might see a bit of that. I don't know. But if that happens, you know, Celtic have just got to keep their heads. Because I think one of the things that we have seen in the SPFL over the last couple of seasons is that there are more teams that are genuinely trying to play football. They may not be playing it to, a really good standard, but they're trying to do the right things. And you kind of hear managers talking about, you know, we're trying to get our team to do the right things. Now, you know, John Hughes, you know, he's doing a decent job with Cali Thistle, and he's done decent jobs with other clubs in Scotland, but he's always tried to get his teams to play football. And even McInnes at Aberdeen, who I don't actually see, I don't see him as being a very kind of expansive manager tactically, and in actual fact he's gone back to being less expansive, which is why they went on a good run, actually. But, you know, Aberdeen, you know, they've got players who at least try to play football. Dundee United, that's definitely the case. But even some of the lesser SPFL Premiership teams like Hamilton, they try to play football. So what that means is Celtic have gone into a lot of games this season where they've not been physically harassed, if you like, during games.
Yeah.
And we may see a little bit more of that at the weekend. And so it's essential that kind of Celtic players kind of keep the composure and kind of don't get sucked into, you know, a tit for tat on that kind of physical game.
And refereeing, obviously it was going to be Bobby Madden, but it's now Craig Thompson.
Was it going to be Bobby Madden, or was that just a rumour? And
I was 19% certain,
right,
that it was announced that it was Bobby Madden and yeah, one other, and yeah, then fans, people started to talk about him being on a UEFA training course, or the fact that there was a UEFA training course the weekend of the UEFA Cup final, and Scotland's better referees will be away.
I'd heard that, but there was just always this talk of Bobby Madden, and then suddenly out of the blue, no pun intended, it just suddenly became, oh, Craig Thompson's going to be refereeing it, and Bobby Madden's going to be away on a UEFA course. And you kind of think, was that always the case? I mean, the fact that we still talk about the referees and who's going to be refereeing these games is down to a couple of things, really. One is, you know, the suspicion about, you know, the overall, intention of referees. But the second one, and the more important one for me, is the overall competence of the referees in Scotland, because they are absolutely atrocious.
Yeah.
They really are awful. And another, the mention of Willie Collum, just, you know, people either fall about laughing, or, you know, they're just kind of enraged at what they see Collum getting away with every week in terms of decisions. But, you know, people say, oh, yeah, well, you know, Craig Thompson, he's steady, he's the best referee. But Craig Thompson himself is absolutely terrible as a referee. Some of the decisions he makes. And I don't think you can absolve the assistants on this as well, because it's them that are making really, really poor decisions as well. You know, if it's wrong calls on offsides and things like that. And I don't know how we get to the point of saying, look, we actually need to stand back from all this, and somebody at the Scottish FA needs to say, this just isn't good enough. We must improve. And what makes it even more galling is that a lot of these referees, the match fee that they're getting each week is probably more than many SPFL Premiership players are being paid per week.
Yeah, I mean, Willie Collum's a good example, because it's not just Celtic fans say that he's biased, or I say the general consensus of all football fans in is he's just not very good.
Well, and that's been too kind to him. You know, he's absolutely awful.
Yeah.
And what a lot of supporters are wondering is whether it's just, yeah, he's just incompetent, and he just doesn't have the ability to call things correctly, or whether he's doing things to make it all about him.
I think he's just, I mean, one of the things that was the thing that started me disliking him was, and I think it might be to do with the way that we play, because a friend of mine who supports the new and old Rangers, when I remember my brother and I continually bemoaning about Colin getting in the way, and he said, oh, I've never really noticed this. But the way that I always felt he got in the way was because we play with our attacking fullbacks, and the way that we will then get to a position where regularly somebody cuts inside and runs along the edge of the 18-yard box, the way they used to do it. And Colin would get would be in the way. But, and I put it down to the fact that a Rangers fan couldn't see that because they play a more direct style of football. But I always felt he's only getting in the way because he's standing in the wrong place because he can't read a game of football to know that that's a key area of where the ball's going to go next.
I think it's that. And I actually think he can't read styles of play of teams. And I think if you see some of the referees in Europe, they're at the top end, some of these referees, but they actually understand the styles of play of certain teams. So they can anticipate where they don't need to be on the park when a team is attacking, because they know how that team attacks. And the most obvious one is Barcelona in recent years, in terms of the way in which they pass the ball around, you know, banks of opposition defenders. Well, if you think it through, Celtic are often, obviously not playing to that standard, but they're playing in a similar style, where they're so far up the field of play that what they're doing is they're trying to break down a bank of opposition defenders that is around the D on the 18-yard area.
Uh-huh.
And a referee, I think I'm right in saying, the referee's positional plays is that they make diagonal runs. When a game is more intense, they'll run diagonally from one corner of an 18-yard box to the corner of another 18-yard box, because for them that's the best way to be able to position themselves to see everything that they need to see to be going on. Well, if you think about it, you run to the end of that diagonal, and where do you arrive? You arrive at the corner of the 18-yard box, and what's happening at that point? Is Aguirre is trying to play a square pass to a Celtic player who is around the edge of that box near the D. And surprise, surprise, who's in the way? A Scottish referee.
Uh-huh. And your point a wee minute ago that someone like Willie Colum, is he just not very good, or is it actually because he's wanting to be the centre of attention and wants too close to the play? Your point there about not understanding how different teams will play, I suppose that's about being self-focused, so that you think your job is to know the rules of football. Would he ever sit and study how the teams in Scotland play so that he can understand where the best places for him to go to not get in the way?
That's exactly right. And the thing is, they are professional referees. So, in the same way that we talk about professional footballers and it's their job, it's the job of those referees. You can't compare professional referees with amateur referees. They should be doing all the things that they need to do to officiate a game in the best possible way that they can.
Yeah, an amateur referee will turn up and he, to some extent, he's got to just apply the rules and referee the game in the way that he referees every game.
Yeah, and good on him for doing it.
Yeah, whereas a professional referee, as you say, has then got to be within the environment of it's a sports entertainment.
Well, you beat me to it now. I mean, I hate to say it, but people talk about football being the entertainment industry. Well, if you believe that concept, then you have to make sure that the officials are ensuring that they do the right thing to make sure that entertainment is at an optimum level. And it isn't about making dodgy decisions or depriving teams of, effectively, space on the park. Sometimes I've watched Celtic games and I've thought, is that referee doing that deliberately? Just standing in the way?
I've watched Celtic games where, and Willie Collins the worst one for it, but I've watched plenty of Celtic games where a Celtic player only has one option, and that's to cut inside. You know, he's been closed off and he's only got one place to go, and he turns and then has to turn back because he can't go because the ref's there. in effect, giving them a 12th man.
Yes, but what you also notice as well is the referee doesn't move. And that's my point about anticipation and understanding what's going on. And, you know, with you saying, yeah, are they just there to kind of, like, make sure the rules are adhered to?
So, well, the referees are what the referees are. What do you think the Celtic lineup's going to be on Sunday?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think most of the team kind of picks itself. Craig Gordon has been absolutely outstanding this season. And we should just say, seeing as I've not been on one of these for a long time, what a fantastic signing for Celtic. He's been absolutely solid. No hint of any injury. I think they rested him, you know, for a couple of games a while back, which was the right thing. But he's been absolutely exceptional, considering we lost such a good goalkeeper who he's actually, you know, I think he's done what most Celtic supporters would hope that he would do in England, you know, that he's actually kind of, you know, he's playing for a team that are playing really well, and he's doing a good job himself. So good luck to him.
Yep. But
Gordon's been absolutely fantastic for us. I think now that we've got Denier back, the centre back pairing picks itself. Virgil and Denier playing together, and I think again, you know, seeing them play, they do the defensive work pretty well overall. I mean, you have to remember, you look at that SPFL league table now, and the amount of goals that we've conceded, it's pretty low. I think it's 12.
Yeah, and considering the point we discussed earlier about many games we play effectively with two at the back.
Correct. So, you know, I think that they're doing the job defensively, but also both of them have got attacking qualities. They can both bring the ball out, and if you're going to be playing teams like we probably are on Sunday, who have strikers or forward players who they're not really interested in doing a lot of hard work closing down defenders who are going to bring the ball out. So again, that could probably suit us. Izaguirre on the left is just, you know, a given. He's having a terrific season. And then on the right, it's a bit more tricky because Lustig's obviously fit. He had a great game in midweek last week. So do you start with him or do you go with Matthews, who actually is just coming back to a bit of form as well?
Mm-hmm.
I think I would probably prefer Lustig because of his overall experience and big game player. I know Matthews is an international with Wales, but I think Lustig's just been around that bit more, and I think you probably get more out of Lustig at the weekend. So I would play him. Beaton's been very solid, so I pick Beaton. Brown, obviously, you know, there's no second thoughts. I mean, I think you're going to get in the build up to this game. You know, is Scott Brown still a hot head? Is he going to lose his cool in this game? I just don't see it. So those two you would have as the solid midfield pairing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a question of who else you go with and kind of who's really fit. So Johansson should be back, and I would pick Johansson because his work rate is just very, very good. And he will pull players around from the opposition and kind of make them think, you know, am I in the right place? Where should I be going? Where shouldn't I be going?
Yep.
So I would have him. And then really it's another three. Do we go with Commons? Is Forrest fit? Is Guidetti going to get us the kind of goals that he's been talking about in the papers that he thinks he might get. Griffiths, Stokes. It's a difficult one, really. I think I would probably go with Guidetti as the striker.
Right.
And then if Forrest is fit, I think I would go with Forrest.
Right.
And possibly I would play Commons for the experience.
So would you play Commons directly behind Guidetti, or would you play Commons out wide and Johansson wide, or would you play Commons wide and Johansson behind Guidetti?
I'd play Johansson behind Guidetti. And to kind of give him more of that kind of free roll. And to be fair, you know, it's not that rigid, is it? So you can get some, you can get some interchange in between Commons and Johansson and Forrest.
But I mean, and to touch on a point you made earlier, that sort of movement amongst those three or even four, including Guidetti, but certainly those three, that's the type of thing that baffles inferior defenders anyway.
Yeah. And for me as well, I mean, the thing is, you know, you talk about your starting 11, but for me, then you've still got options on the bench, you know. So, I mean, I think Griffiths is doing quite well currently. I think he's knuckling down and he's doing what he needs to do. We're assuming that Stokes is fit. I mean, Ronnie Dyler said that there's only Mulgrew who isn't fit. So,
which is a shame.
What has happened to Dirk Bo Richter?
I read somewhere.
Where is he? Where is he?
He was back in training last week for the first time in 3 months.
Well, we'll start with we need to have him starting just so that we can, you know, if he's on the payroll, we need to see him.
Did he get injured after that alleged dive against St Johnstone? Is that the problem? But you're right. He's one of these people who you think to yourself, he's been out for months, and suddenly there's a thing saying, yeah, he's now back. And you think, well, I never read anywhere that he was injured in the first place.
Do you know what? When you're at work and you yourself are either phoning in sick, or you've got somebody phoning in sick, and they've been off for a little while, you know, and you kind of leave it, and they've got a doctor's note, and, you know, saying, I'm not going to be in today. I'm still a bit under the weather. And do you think Dirk's ringing? Do you think he rings Peter Lowell or Ronnie or every so often? Say, I'm still not feeling so good, boss.
Yeah, do you know? I actually think.
But I might be back in next week.
Yeah, I might be in next week, and they go. And Dial puts the phone down and says, "Remember that guy, Dirk Bo Richter? He's still here. I thought he'd gone."
Yeah.
I think for him, for players like him, and I think Sean Maloney was the same at Celtic, I think they've had an injury problem at some point in their career. And it then gets to the point where they actually don't know when they're fit enough to play football.
Yeah.
Because, as I've heard many professional athletes say, actually, once you're a top person performing, particularly footballers or rugby players, playing every week, you're never 100%. You'll always get a niggle or something.
Yeah.
And I think they get a bad injury and then forget what feeling good enough to play is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point, really. But I think in the modern game, call me a cynic on this, but I think there are some players who actually, they've made it to a certain level and they've got to the point where they're not actually that interested in playing football.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you know, if you had to name some Celtic players who would kind of try and play through a pain barrier, or you know, do things that they shouldn't really do because they still love playing football, you know, then you could probably identify them fairly easily. I mean, you know, for all his kind of mixed views about him, Griffiths is like that. You can tell that all that Griffiths wants to do is play football. That's all he's interested in.
Yeah, which actually, and this is one of the things that I think people have, some of the people who maybe not immediately warm to or come round to Ronnie Dyer's way of thinking, that I can see in some of the team selections, if you hear the way that Ronnie Dyer has spoken about players or the way he wants people to behave in training or various things like that,
yeah.
And then you hear some comments that players have made when they've been interviewed post-games, whatever, and then you suddenly see a guy in the team. I think Ronnie Dyer's man management style some may well be that he rewards people who are trying as much as anything else. You know, that, and that Griffiths, I get the impression Griffiths is in the team now because he's trying to do what Ronnie Dyer wants him to do.
Exactly.
And you reward effort.
Exactly right. That's spot on in my view. And the other thing is, what they also realise is, and what Ronnie Dyer realises is, I can't start with a blank piece of paper here. I can't just put a red line through everybody's name and start again. I mean, people talk about it, and, you know, I've said it a few times in conversations, you know. People say it takes two or three transfer windows for a manager to get the kind of players that he really thinks he needs. Now, some people would say, oh, well, that's buying time. But I don't think it is. So what Ronnie Dyer will be impressed with is those people who he thinks, well, he's never actually going to attain the standard that I really want. But as you say, he's trying to do the best that he possibly can in the job that I've given him to do.
And then somebody might listen to this and say, so why then not just play the talented player over the guy given effort? And I just think from a man management perspective, because that's what you're actually saying to the talented guy. You may have more talent than this guy, but this guy's trying harder. So yeah, he's in the team. If you try like him, yeah, you'll be in the team.
Yeah, but the other thing is you never reach your long term objectives. All you're doing is kind of like short termism. And okay, people say, oh yeah, well, football is short termism. It's about winning the next game. But I disagree with that. Celtic have actually got to change the whole of their outlook on how they're organised as a club. And they've got to do that for the long-term benefit. They've done some of those things already on a financial basis, and we've kind of seen, oh yeah, you know, we're scouring the market and we're bringing players in, and hopefully they can have a couple of good seasons and then we sell them on. And, you know, okay, some people don't like that, but, you know, that's the reality. But the next phase is actually changing the philosophy of the club that has an attitude about how you do your job right from when you're 17 and signing your kind of first professional forms, so that we actually don't need to be scouring the market as much, but that we have players with ability who come through the ranks but have got the right attitude as well.
Yeah.
And you're not going to do that between, you know, when did Ronnie Dyer come, July, and even now. You know, you're talking about a 4 or 5 year project. Then, you know, I mean, maybe it's not for today, but we need to have a podcast about, you know, what's happening at youth level. Because, you know, you do hear some things that are not entirely positive about the, you know, what's happening at youth level. But all of that needs addressing.
But it's interesting, as you were talking there, I was just thinking about 25 plus years ago, we used to laugh at Johnny Foreigner, and particularly places like Spain and Italy, where managers turned around every 18 months, and we used to say, how can you possibly develop a club and build a team when you're doing that? Now, if a manager's not made an instant impact inside 2 months, people are saying he's a dud and we'll need to move him on inside 6 months.
But part of the reason for that as well is because increasingly all of those comments have been being made against the benchmark of something like the English Premier League or one of the other moneyed leagues. where, you know, if there's failure, the cash is there to make an immediate quick fix. Well, we just don't have that at Celtic. So you have to look at, you know, the kind of the Ajax model, the Porto model, those kinds of places, and build for both medium term and long term benefit.
Yeah, there's a thing called the football price index, which is obviously trying to do an RPI, taking into account football transfers. It's obviously based around English stuff, and just your point there about comparing with England. Mm. I did a calculation using their stuff. Chris Sutton would be on 75. You know, people talk about, and this is for another podcast, people talk about Celtic downsizing, and I say it's not. From my own perspective, I think it's not a downsizing, it's a readjustment.
Exactly.
And the reason it's a readjustment is because Chris Sutton would be on £75,000 a week based on football inflation, and would have cost us just under £18 million to buy.
Yeah.
Well, bearing in mind that John Hartson was also acquired at the same price band within a 12-month window, so he's also an £18 million player on £75,000 a week. And Larson, I didn't do the calculations, but he was on more than them. So just for us to have the same quality as we had under O'Neill, on those three players, would have a wage bill from those three players alone of roughly, £260,000 a week. From those three players alone, and the transfers from those three players alone would have been probably about £35 million. Patently, we can't behave like that, and we have to change our culture.
No, but the thing is, the converse element of that is that there are clubs who are regarded as small clubs in the English Premier League who can afford those wages and those transfer fees, and that's what makes it. That's what gives it that kind of double whammy effect, you know. And I see. I mean, I don't look at some of these things these days, but, you know, if you look at the kind of, I don't know, the Crystal Palaces, the Hull Cities, the Burnleys, the Stokes, the amount of money that each of those clubs is spending relative to Celtic is it would have been unheard of even 10 years ago.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, it's that kind of context. You know, sometimes I wonder, you know, we'll get into the independence thing, but, you know, if Scotland was a kind of like, you know, an independent nation that was placed anywhere else in Europe, would the same conversations be going on about Scottish football and the fact that it doesn't have money?
Well, we certainly wouldn't have the situation where our national broadcaster was subsidising another nation's TV coverage.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you know, those issues, and we've spoken about it before, I've written about it before, it's just something that, you know, I think is inherently wrong about the way in which those TV contracts are cut, given the proximity of Scotland to England geographically, and the way in which Sky are marketing to a single market. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
Yep.
And it is to the detriment of Scottish football. And I've said all along, you know, I might have the phraseology wrong, but to me it's a restraint of trade. And it's restricting, and it's actually strangling certain elements of the Scottish game. You know, and at times I wish all football was played with less money in it. But, you know, we are where we are. That's the reality. So if that's the reality, then, you know, there should be some forms of compensation to the Scottish game. It will just continue to get squeezed.
Well, we decided to keep this podcast short, and it's been Not. I just got one other thing to ask you about the Cup semi-final. In addition to your score prediction, which I'll ask you to do right at the very end, there is one other very small thing just to cover briefly, and that has been the weird media coverage in the last 3 or 4 days that seems to only be to trot out former players of both sides to say Rangers are the same club and to talk about what bad songs the Naughty Boys are all going to sing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, like a lot of people, I just despair at the mainstream media in terms of the coverage. And at the end of the day, a lot of these people, a lot of the individuals who are involved in this, they can only see this as kind of increasing their status and protecting their livelihood. And I think, we've got to a sad state of affairs where there's just no seeming will on the part of the mainstream media to look at the rest of Scottish football in any meaningful way and say, do you know what? There are some really, really good things going on. And that's what we want to focus on.
Yeah, I think that summed up for me two things. One, to some extent, some fans can be a bit like that as well, in that those Celtic fans who've been critical of Ronnie Dyla have been critical of Ronnie Dyla basically because we've had a challenge from a team that's not the old Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
Ignoring the fact that Aberdeen had a 10-game unbeaten run domestically.
Absolutely. And what that's got to do with Celtic is beyond me. If Aberdeen are performing pretty well and they're getting the results, the only way Celtic can influence that is when Celtic play Aberdeen.
And then the other patronising thing getting into the media was a tweet I saw today, which I thought was great, which was, the most patronising phrase used by the Scottish media in the last 10 days has been the other cup final. Mm. Or the other cup semi-final.
Yeah. And do you know what? That's a pretty big game. With two, I would say, pretty strong teams. For different reasons, they've come at it in different ways. Dundee United, obviously bringing a lot of players through the youth ranks and supplementing them with some pretty astute signings. Aberdeen have tended to bring players in who are of a particular standard. So, but they're both decent teams, regardless of what anybody says.
So what's your predictions? First of all, what's your prediction for the Aberdeen-Dundee United game?
Do you know what? I think Dundee United might win that.
So do I.
I know Aberdeen have slipped up recently, and we're kind of pleased about that because that's good from Celtic's point of view. But I think Dundee United, they're just a lot more fluent in the football and attack minded. I've seen them a few times and they're a decent team to watch, and I think they probably might cause Aberdeen quite a few problems. And it depends how Aberdeen set up. Aberdeen are a pretty good counter-attacking team, so they'll probably be thinking, well, we're quite happy for Dundee United to take the game to us, and we'll pick them off on the break. But no, I think that'll be a decent game, but I think Dundee United possibly win that.
Okay, and then on to our game. One thing I did think was interesting, Ronnie Dyla was asked in the press conference about his comments on what did he think of Hampden's pitch as a national stadium for a Cup semi-final, and he said it wasn't the best. And as soon as he said that, I thought, and there'll have been a game played on it less than 24 hours earlier.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I thought as well. That, if that's not a decent pitch, and to be honest with you, every time these things come up, we We as supporters, we are always questioning Hampden in one way, shape or form. You know, sometimes it might be the pitch. I mean, it's always going to be the stadium and the stands themselves, because it's atrocious. An atrocious venue to watch football. You know, unless you get a decent seat in the main stand, it's just not a good place to watch football.
So
you could say, well, maybe Ronnie Dalloway was coming up with the excuses earlier. I don't think it was. He was just stating the facts that the pitch is obviously in a bad way. And as you point out, if Dundee United and Aberdeen play on it, then it's not going to be in the best of shapes. And obviously, with the weather being the way it is at this time of the year, you know, that's not good. But if there's a bit of grass on it, it's reasonably smooth. Celtic can knock it about. We really shouldn't be thinking that's too much of a problem.
So your prediction of a score?
I think we should win comfortably. And by comfortably, I think what I mean there is I think we'll be on the attack for most of the game. I think we will, as usual, create quite a lot of chances. There are games this season where we've seen Celtic and, you know, they've maybe won 1 or 2 nil. And you thought, actually, you know, some of those chances they've hit the woodwork, that really could have been 4 or 5 or 6. So I think I'll probably say we'll probably win by two goals, definitely. And, you know, if it all just goes well on the day, then we could be looking at 3 or 4.
Here's hoping.
Yep.
Okay, well, as I say, our plan is to keep it succinct. It's not quite been, but I think actually what you've done is made me think there's about another 4 things, different topics of conversation that you and I need to have on a podcast. So
that's always the way. So yeah. I'll see you in about 6 months.
Okay, thanks, Hellboy. Cheers.
Take care.
Bye.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark.
I hope you enjoyed that. I'm going to stay away from expressing my thoughts on what I predict the League Cup semi-final to be. As I think I've said, books such as Soccernomics illustrate that of all major team sports, football's the one that has the greatest amount of luck in the outcome of individual matches. I think the statistical analysis is that 50% of any football match is luck. So you can always get, as we saw against Stabroth, the lucky shot off the heel, off the backside, whatever. So fingers crossed, we get a League Cup semi. I have my podcast and its music planned for every eventuality after that. Suffice to say, enjoy the game. Speak to you soon. This is me, Harry Beattie, saying goodnight. Goodnight.